Okay, we're going to resume our study of the return from captivity period in a moment. We are talking about Nehemiah these days, and we've been moving from left to right across this chart that you can see on the screen, and today we're going to be over on the, again, on the far right-hand side, talking about Nehemiah and the events that happened when he was there in Jerusalem. What we're going to be talking about today, we think, happened during the year 445 B.C., perhaps 444. There's a little wiggle room there. Talking about the finishing up of the building of the walls, the city walls of Jerusalem, and then some things that happened right after that, which to me sort of amounted to a revival or a restoration of the Jewish religion. And we find this, of course, in the book of Nehemiah, and you can see on the chart there. They think the dates of his book are from about 445 to 415 B.C. So we will get back into that in a moment, but let's start with a prayer. Father in heaven, we are truly thankful for this beautiful morning that we have to enjoy. Thankful also for the opportunity to be here. As we read about the events in these latter chapters of Nehemiah, we note the Israelites confessing their sins, and we note that you had repeatedly showed them mercy. And all this reminds us that we too are sinful. We need to confess our sins to you, and we are confident that you are also merciful to us. And for this, we are truly thankful. We pray that you would be with us this morning as we study. We pray these things in your son's name. Amen. Okay, when we were wrapping up at the end of last week's session, we were talking about the fact that the walls were in the course of being rebuilt, and that there was opposition to the process. And I'll go back and just review a couple of the things that we had seen last week. We noted that the progression of this opposition started with little more than mocking, just kind of making fun of the Jews. But then the threat started to increase. The next thing we noted that the mocking increased in terms of the numbers of the people involved. And in chapter 4 of Nehemiah, verses 2 and 3, we read about this guy, Sanballat, recruiting more mockers, you might say. And we read that he recruited, well, he was at a meeting apparently with his brothers, the army of Samaria, and this other enemy, Tobiah. And what we're going to notice, I've got a series of slides that we're going to work our way through that note the progression of all this opposition to the building of the walls. And when we're done, we'll have eight things on this table. We're at number 2 right now with Sanballat getting more mockers in chapter 4, verses 2 and 3. So on the left-hand side of these slides, we'll have the opposition. And on the right-hand side, we'll have the responses, either of Nehemiah individually or the Jews as a group. And so the response to the mocking kind of increasing was prayer. Nehemiah prayed in verses 4 and 5 of chapter 4. Okay, so what was the next thing that happened? The opposition ramped up a little bit. It moved on from mockery to some of the enemies actually planning an attack in the city of Jerusalem. The stated effect of that was to be to create confusion. And we find that in verse 8 of chapter 4. And the response of the Jews was to pray and to set a guard day and night to protect themselves. And so this gets us to the next line on our table, where we have the enemies conspiring to fight, conspiring to make this attack in Jerusalem, and the Jews in response praying and getting ready to repel this attack if need be. Okay, then it got a little bit more intense. The next thing was that the enemies planned an attack, another plan for an attack, but this one seemed to be potentially a little bit more intense because they now are talking about doing an attack which would have the effect of killing some of the Jews and even putting a total stop to the work on the walls. And in response to that, Nehemiah has the people take some defensive steps. Now, it seems that the situation around this time was that the Jews who were living outside of the city, who were in towns or villages that were close to the territories of these enemies, they were getting really worried. They were scared that the enemies were going to attack them in their outlying towns. And it seems that the men, or some of the men of these outlying places, had actually come into Jerusalem to help with the work on the wall construction. And their families were now concerned and wanting them to come home and protect their own homes. And so this is a problem. And although the text, to me anyway, isn't extremely clear on this point, it seems that we can infer that Nehemiah encouraged some of these people to actually come into the city of Jerusalem for protection. And what he did was he stationed people by clans or families, which when you think about it is kind of a good idea. I think history shows over and over again that people fight better if they are fighting alongside people that they're close to. So that was probably his thinking there. And so he gets them stationed and ready to fight, and that gets us to this shows on the fourth line of our table. The enemies have planned this attack, and now the Jews in response are showing force in that they are being organized and put into place with weapons and ready to fight. And it's around this time that Nehemiah tries to encourage them. If you look at verse 14 of chapter 4, he tells them, "Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes." So, as we noted last week, he is encouraging the people to rely on God, but not only that, to work with God, that it would be a collaborative effort, that they would rely on God to help them, but they would also do their part. And so that's what's going on here. Once again, don't be afraid of them, but he has also taken steps to get them ready so that they would be able to participate in their own defense. They weren't going to just sit there and hope that God would protect them. So, with that said, they were careful, and the work continued, and they were not attacked. And it seems like these enemies had some degree of fear of the God of the Jews, because they didn't actually come and attack. And we read that half of Nehemiah's own servants were working on the wall, and half of his servants were nearby holding weapons. So that's a rather unusual scene if you think about it. His servants, and he's the governor, and he's got half his servants working on the wall construction, and the other half are standing nearby with weapons. And this I would submit, showed some wisdom on his part, as well as faith in God. Nehemiah seemed to recognize that he was the leader, and that he needed to set the right example, and that he needed to do his part in the construction of the walls. And so that's exactly what he was doing here. But the thing that stands out to me is that this was really a tense situation. We read in verses 17 and 18 about the fact that people were working with their weapons, either on them or sitting right nearby. It's hard for me to imagine a situation like that, being out there hauling these big rocks and trying to build a wall, while at the same time having to have weapons a couple of feet away, thinking that at any moment we could be attacked. But that seems to have been the case. That was the situation they were dealing with, really tense. And they had a number of people with trumpets, and the workers were told that if they heard the trumpet sound, people should rally to wherever that noise was coming from, because it would signify an attack, and they needed to respond if they heard the trumpet sound. Okay, that was where we had kind of wound up last week, a little bit beyond there maybe. But let's start with new material now. Roman numeral 2 on your outline. We're gonna read about the opposition to the wall construction continuing. But the wall is going to be finished. Rob.
I can't help but think, as we look at this and how how they were building and working together. And, you know, and the other verse that says, on one hand, they build, you know, they were building and doing the work. On the other hand, they had the sword. I mean, you know, to me, there's an example there for us in terms of how we, you know, need to be at times. You know, I then think of the armor of God, you know, in Ephesians 6, where, it, you know, we have the shield of faith, and then we have a sword of the Spirit and the truth, and that we, you know, we use the shield in some ways to protect us. They were trying to build a wall to protect, and then they used the sword to attack or defend if they had to, and that's what we do with the Word of God. And so I just, you know, I just came to mind and put it out there.
Yeah, thank you. It's a good analogy. Our situation, I guess, is a lot better than theirs in the sense that we have the armor of God, but while they were, I have to think they were hampered in their work to some degree, having to hold a weapon in one hand and place stones with the other hand. We're not hampered at all, obviously, with the armor of God. It helps us. And so I'm thankful for that. I'm sure you are too. But I think Rob makes a good point. There's a good analogy there. Well, while this is going on, these enemies are not retiring from the scene completely. They're not going to give up quite yet. They have heard that the walls have been built, although the gates and the doors on the gates and the locks and so on are not in place yet. And so there's been progress, but they're not done. And so these enemies decide to take a new approach. And instead of just mocking and instead of planning an attack on the city, they're going to do something different. They're going to ask Nehemiah to come meet them. They want to have a meeting with him, they say. And this is going to be in the plain of Ono, they say. And if you look on the screen, you can see up in the upper left corner the plain of Ono area. And you can see Jerusalem almost right in the center of the green Judea section. And so they want Nehemiah to leave Jerusalem and come up into this yellow area for a supposed meeting. And, of course, what was their plan in reality? Do they want to talk to him?
To kill him, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I think to kill him or at the very least to arrest him. Yeah. To do whatever to take him out of the work situation. But Nehemiah was not stupid, and he knew what was going on, and he just simply refused to go up there and meet him. And he noted that he was doing, as he put it, a great work, and I cannot come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you? I read that, and it struck me as kind of interesting. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you? He says in verse 3 of chapter 6. I wonder, why would all the work have to stop completely if he left for a couple of hours or a day or two or something? And yet that seems to have been the situation. That's what he was saying anyway. It suggests that he really was a towering leader, and he really was absolutely necessary to the construction work. Remember, if you think back to chapter 2, the end of that chapter in verse 20, and of course we don't memorize all this, but in that verse, these mockers had confronted Nehemiah, and at that time, back in chapter 2, verse 20, he had told them, "You have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem." He had given them that blunt response to their mockery back at that time. So now, why should these characters expect that they should be able to have a meeting with Nehemiah? What would make them think that he would want to take the time and the trouble to go up to the plain of Ono and meet with him? And, of course, he didn't. So what happened next? Well, let me get to our next line here. What we've just discussed, they had planned this ambush, and Nehemiah had showed wisdom, and he had showed courage in not going up there, just bluntly refusing and pretty much talking tough to him. And so the next thing that happens is that Sanballat, he sends, before that, I should note that they sent a total of four letters before they recognized, I guess, for sure that Nehemiah wasn't coming. And then Sanballat takes a new tack, and he sends a fifth letter, and he accuses Nehemiah and the Jews of building these walls as part of a planned rebellion against King Artaxerxes. And he alleges in that letter that the idea is for Nehemiah to become the king of the Jews, and he threatens that he's going to make a false accusation about this to Artaxerxes about Nehemiah. This is preposterous, of course, because it was Artaxerxes that gave Nehemiah permission to come back to Jerusalem and do this work. But Sanballat doesn't seem to understand that, and so he tries to make this threat. And we have Nehemiah once again understanding completely what the situation is, and he prays for strength. And all of this, I think, is an interesting contrast to what we saw a few weeks ago. Think back to 536 BC when they are starting to rebuild the temple, and they get that temple foundation laid, and then opposition comes, and what happened? Well, Ezra records that they just caved in completely, and they stopped work on the temple. And it took 20 years for the temple to be finished. It took, you know, prophecy from Haggai and Zechariah and a lot of encouragement before they finished the temple. So they, back in 536, they had knuckled under completely to opposition. That's not what's going on this time around with the walls, with Nehemiah. He's standing firm, and he's not going to cave into the opposition whatsoever. And so we've just seen that there's been this false accusation, line 6 on our table, and Nehemiah denies it, and once again he prays. Note that. We see him praying over and over again throughout this narrative. Okay, now the opposition is going to take even a little different turn in that it's going to start to come from inside Jerusalem, from inside the Jewish community. This character, Shemaiah, who really was a traitor apparently, he goes to Nehemiah and he tells him, your enemies are going to come, and in the middle of the night they're going to murder you, they're going to kill you. And so I think you should take refuge with me inside the temple. And that's a smart thing for you to do under these circumstances. But Nehemiah, of course, refused to do that. And he was emphatic that he wasn't going to do that, that it would be the wrong thing to do. What would have been wrong with Nehemiah taking refuge in the temple if it would have saved his life from these guys?
He wasn't a Levite or a priest.
Yeah, that's a big problem right there. He's not a priest, so he's not supposed to go in there. Would have been a violation of the law. And a second reason, I suppose, is that it would have reflected a lack of faith and a lack of courage on his part. Remember, he had been encouraging the people back in, I think it was chapter 4, verse 14 that we looked at a few moments ago. He was telling the people to rely on God and take courage. It would be pretty unseemly for him to be exhorting the people to be courageous and for him then to hide in the temple and not have faith in God. And in that sense, it would have been sinful, I suppose. But he was emphatic that he wasn't going to do that. And he perceived very well that Shemaiah was not legitimate. He had been put up to this by these enemies. And so he knew that Sanballat and Tobiah were really behind this. And he knew that Shemaiah wanted him to go inside the temple so that they would be able to sully his reputation and to reduce his standing in the community. And so he prayed again. And this time he prayed that God remember his enemies. And this is another case, I suppose, of what we called an imprecatory prayer a couple weeks ago. It's another example of a faithful man of God praying for God to not look kindly on his enemies. And so now we're almost at the end of our little table here of the opposition. The seventh one that we've just mentioned was these enemies trying to set up a slander of Nehemiah to try to make him look bad and thus hopefully impair the work. But Nehemiah had proved faithful and he had prayed once again. So in the end, despite opposition, despite all this opposition, the walls were finished. And amazingly, they were built in 52 days. That is really, it's kind of hard for me to wrap my mind around that when I think of the extent of the work that was involved there with those big stones. And they're having to constantly be concerned about being attacked and, you know, working, carrying a weapon with one hand and having weapons nearby in cases where they had to actually use two hands to do the work. But they were done, and we're told in the text that the enemies were discouraged, and they were actually kind of afraid because of this, because they could tell that the God of the Jews was helping them out in this matter. And so you would think that all of that would end the opposition, wouldn't you? But it did not. The opposition is going to continue. It's going to be both external and internal. What we're going to find here is communication going on between some nobles of Judah and one of those enemies, Tobiah. Nobles, I suppose, were prominent people in the community in terms of status and wealth and perhaps property. I'm not sure how that term noble would be defined exactly. But what we see here is something rather strange. We see that one of these main enemies, Tobiah, has actually married the daughter of a prominent Jew. And his son has done the same thing. His son has also married the daughter of a prominent Jew. And so we have that problem again of the Jews marrying non-Jews, people of the land. And the reason it strikes me as strange is that, remember, a week or two ago we were talking about Ezra and how he had to confront the problem of the intermarriage with the local peoples. And remember that painful process they had to go through that took months to sort out who all was involved in that and to get those marriages undone and the foreign wives and the foreign children sent back to where they ought to be. Well, that had only been about 12 years ago. And now we're reading about Tobiah having married the daughter of a prominent Jew. And there's all this communication going back and forth between some of the prominent Jews in Jerusalem and Tobiah. And as a result of this, Tobiah sends letters to frighten Nehemiah. And that takes us to the end of our chart of the opposition. He sent these letters. We're not told what Nehemiah did in response. I have to assume he prayed, because that was his usual. Okay, the next thing we have, Roman numeral 3 on your outline. I'll zip through this one kind of quickly. It's just about Nehemiah getting a few things in order, organized. He gets the gatekeepers and the singers and the Levites appointed to their duties, and so that everybody knows what they're supposed to do. He arranges for protection for the city, for the city gates to be guarded, for them to be locked at the end of the day. He has prayed often, as we've seen, but again, he has recognized that the people need to do their part of the work as well. So he's not going to have the people just sit there and do nothing and leave the gates unlocked all night or to not guard the gates in the daytime. And despite all the opposition that we've seen, eight lines on our table here, it's kind of interesting that at no point in time did these enemies actually attack. They just didn't. And why do you suppose that was?
Because God's hand was upon them.
Yeah, and these enemies seem to have a fear to some extent of the God of the Jews. They could see, as we just noted a few moments ago, that he had been involved in helping them build these walls that quickly. And along with that, and related to it, they were well aware that the Jews were prepared and they were willing to fight. And so they just didn't attack. And then we read that God put it into Nehemiah's heart to enroll the people by genealogy. And we have a list of people there. And the list really corresponds to the one that we saw back in Ezra chapter 2. And why was this list important, just listing all the people that had come back to Jerusalem. There's a good reason for having it recorded. Can you think of what it is?
Well, the connection to the land, for one thing, needed to be reaffirmed.
Yeah.
It shows to us that God kept his promise about bringing him back.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, God had made this promise a long time ago back to Abraham that in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed, he had told them. A Messiah is going to come. There have been a number of prophecies about that Messiah, and there will be more before he comes. But in order to prove that Jesus is that Messiah, they need to have records. They need to be able to show in the records who he is and how he has descended. So I think that is a major reason for it. Okay, Roman numeral 4. We're going to come to what was really a pretty amazing week. They're going to do some important things in this week. And we read about it in chapter 8. The immediate setting for the events of Nehemiah chapter 8. We're in the seventh month of their calendar. And that's an important month on the Jewish calendar. The Passover is in the first month of the Jewish year. The Pentecost is in the third month. But in the seventh month, the one we're dealing with here, they've got Rosh Hashanah, which is their new year. They've got Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. They've got the Feast of Booths, or the Feast of Tabernacles, if you will. All of that is in the seventh month. It's a big, important period. And it falls around the last half of September and early October, which is, I'm told, a nice time of year in Jerusalem, where I suspect the assembly that we're going to talk about here in a moment took place right about the same time of year that we're at today. And the weather probably would have been kind of similar to this beautiful day that we're enjoying here. Sunshine and mild temperature. That was probably the situation there in Jerusalem when they get together and have Ezra read the law. And so, after all this time, after all the opposition that they have had to face, they probably were feeling pretty good. They probably had a feeling that they really are back. They have done their three returns and they're back in Jerusalem. And the walls are built. They have their temple. Things are good. Nehemiah has stood strong and he has encouraged them and they have gotten things done. And now we have this great moment. The people are all together. They are gathered in safety behind completed walls with gates. And I think they could really feel like they're back. So we read about them gathering in verse 1. They're going to gather in a square in front of the water gate, and they're going to ask Ezra to read the book of the law of Moses. This slide maybe suggests where the water gate was. I think the scholars don't know for sure exactly where it was. But just to the right of that white line or arrow, you see kind of a tower that's referred to as the projecting tower, and it is thought that the water gate was right near that tower, and the water gate would have ostensibly been close to the Gihon Spring, the water source that you might recall being routed into the city by Hezekiah. Anyway, they were going to meet in a square. They did meet in a square inside the walls behind that gate. From the looks of this, it's hard to see how there's a square there, but I would attribute that to an error in the design of this model, because I think we know that there was a square because they had to get a lot of people together there. So as we go through this, a good thing to keep in mind is that what we're thinking about and talking about here happened at the request of the people. Ezra didn't take it upon himself to just get them together and read the law. The people assembled, and they asked Ezra to read the law. And he did. In response, he did a long reading of the law. And here's a description of what happened. The verses 2 and 3 of Nehemiah chapter 8, where it says, "So Ezra the priest brought the law before the assembly, both men and women, and all who could understand what they heard, on the first day of the seventh month. And he read from it facing the square before the water gate from early morning until midday in the presence of the men and women and those who could understand. And the ears of the people were attentive to the book of the law. So early morning to midday, that's a lot of reading. Probably, it sounds like it could have been 5 or 6 hours. In fact, the law required them to have this kind of meeting and to have the law read in this way every 7 years. It was supposed to be done in connection with the Feast of Booths or the Feast of Tabernacles. The problem was they had not been observing the Feast of Booths for about 1,000 years since the time of Joshua. And I don't know to what extent they had the law read. We in our earlier study, we saw a few instances of the law being read, perhaps, but it was not done regularly every 7 years the way it was supposed to be done. So it's going to happen now, and it's a very solemn occasion, lending gravity to the whole atmosphere. 13 other men joined Ezra up on this podium as he was doing the reading, and when he started to read, the people stood up out of respect. I found myself wondering whether they continued to stand during the entire reading. I rather doubt it. The text doesn't say. Well, they responded, and their response was dramatic. It involved reverence, but it also involved weeping. We see that in chapter 8, verses 6 to 9. We're told that they expressed great reverence. They worshiped with their faces to the ground. And we had Levites going through the crowd and explaining the meaning of the text that they were hearing. And Nehemiah, Ezra, and the Levites, when they saw that the hearing of the law was causing the people to weep, they discouraged that. They explained that the occasion simply did not call for that. They said, "This day is holy to the Lord your God. Do not mourn or weep." And so I asked myself, why was it that they were weeping? Why would they be inclined to weep on this occasion, on this what really was a great day? Any idea?
It may have been the same reason that Josiah was so shocked to hear the prophecies about what was going to happen in life.
Yeah, I think that's right. I have the sense that as they listened to the reading of the law, they recognized how far short they had fallen, and they recognized their failure. There's another possible alternative idea, I suppose. Remember when we were talking about the laying of the temple foundation and how some of the older people who had been in Jerusalem before, and they were looking at it, at the new foundation, and they were crying and weeping, and we talked about the fact there were possible alternative interpretations of that. The first being that they were just upset because it was not going to be anywhere near as grand as the old Temple of Solomon had been. But then we posed another possibility that perhaps it was just because they were emotionally overwhelmed at the significance of the event that they were seeing. And it could have been something like this going on here in this situation. We have this probably a beautiful day. At a very important time on their calendar, they are back. They've got their temple. They've got the walls built. They're organized. Everything seems to be going great. And maybe the totality of all that was just overwhelming to them emotionally. We don't know. The text doesn't say why they wept, really. But the Levites moved through the crowd and calmed them down. So the next day, I mean, this continued. This process didn't stop with one day. The very next day, we have some of the heads of the households, the priests and the Levites, gathering around Ezra for further instruction in the words of the law. We see that in verse 13 of chapter 8. Evidently, they really wanted more knowledge, and they wanted Ezra to teach them. And one of the things they found as they heard the law read was the instructions concerning the Feast of Booths, the Feast of Tabernacles. And they knew that, having heard that, they needed to comply with the provisions of the law in that regard. And amazingly, they hadn't been doing this, as I noted a moment ago, since the days of Joshua, for about 1,000 years. And I found that kind of hard to understand. They had had some good kings, in the southern kingdom anyway. How was it that this was just ignored for all these years? In the times of Hezekiah, in the times of Josiah, and so on. But evidently it had been. Well, they decided to reinstate the Feast of Booths, and they engaged in great rejoicing, it says in verse 17. And this feast reminded them, of course, of their 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, right? And the booths that they were supposed to construct reminded them of the fact that they had come out of captivity and the Lord had provided for them through their years of wandering. And perhaps these people, in the situation we're talking about now, had similar thoughts, thinking they had come back from captivity and they are now on their own. And they were quite happy to reinstate the Feast of Booths. And Ezra read from the book of the law every day for 7 days during that feast. Well, the next thing we come to is the people confessing their sin and the covenant being renewed. And it had been 24 days since Ezra had read the law, but we read about the people assembling once again. And this time they're fasting and they're in sackcloth and with earth on their heads. And they confess their sins. We see that in the opening verses of chapter 9. And they had presumably been studying the law for this 24-day period. They had lived in booths and they had resumed their faithful service to God. And now they read the law again. And in connection with all this, they are led in an amazing public prayer that we see starting at the end of chapter 9, verse 5, and going all the way through verse 38. So Nehemiah 9, verses 5 through 38, it's a prayer, and it's the longest prayer in the entire Bible, apparently. Someone, we don't know who, seems to have stood up and prayed this prayer. It doesn't really require a lot of commentary, and so I'm not going to say much about it. But it repeatedly emphasizes the greatness and the mercy of God, even though his people had repeatedly rebelled. And it magnifies God over and over again. It foreshadows the New Testament gospel message of salvation by grace through faith, I would say. Because in the prayer we have this pattern of the people's disobedience and rebellion, and then God showing mercy. And my intent was to, I have a few times in the past refrained from reading a long prayer in the class session. This one I want to read because it is an excellent summary of what we've been studying now for a couple years. And what I've done is I've gone through the prayer and I have some slides and the text, the part of the prayer where the people are confessing their sins and the sins of their fathers, I've got in red text, and when I thought of doing this, I decided to put statements about God's mercy and the ways he had helped them in green text. And I didn't get far into this before I recognized it's going to be almost all green. And so I decided, well, for the green text statements about God, I'm going to limit those to just a couple that are general statements of his mercy and his just keeping his promises to them and doing right by them. And so plainly, we're not going to have time to do that this morning. I think I'll start next week by doing that because I think it's worthwhile. And we will come back to that prayer next week. We're going to see that toward the end of the prayer, they assert that even as good as things are, in effect, they are slaves in their own country. We see that in verses 36 and 37. They note that everything pretty much was subject to the whims of the Persian king, Artaxerxes. And so they're in great distress, they say. And I think they make an implied request for relief from the rule of Artaxerxes right at the end of this prayer in verse 38. They've gone through all this recitation of the sins of the people and God's mercy and goodness to the people. And then they note that they are in great distress. And they say in verse 38, Because of all this, we make a firm covenant in writing. On the sealed document are the names of our princes, our Levites, and our priests. And so I think this amounted to a declaration on their part to be faithful to God. And implied in that, I think they were hoping that God would relieve what they characterized as their slavery to the Persians. I think the prayer here seems to reflect the fact that they had been reading the law or having the law read to them now for a period of perhaps 24 days. We know that it was read to them for 7 or 8 days back at the start of the month. And I presume they had been continuing to talk about it and have it read to them in the intervening days too. So maybe 24 days they have been thinking about the law, and this prayer seems to reflect that, I think. So Nehemiah is going to head the list of those who signed this firm covenant in writing, this pledge that they're going to serve God faithfully. And we find this chapter 10 has a lot of things that I'm going to skip over, a lot of names and so forth, but toward the end of chapter 10, in verses 28 and 29, we find all the people and their leaders entering into what they call a curse and an oath to walk in God's law, the law that was given by Moses, a servant of God, and to observe and do all the commandments of the Lord our God and his rules and his statutes. That's in verses 28 and 29 of chapter 10. And as part of that, they made some specific pledges. Sadly, we're going to see probably next week that they didn't take too long for them to violate these pledges. They pledged not to intermarry with foreign neighbors, not to buy or sell on the Sabbath with these foreign neighbors. They were going to forego crops of the seventh year and the exaction of every debt. And they were going to give proper portions to God and the service of his people. And they closed by saying, "We will not neglect the house of our God." Well, as we're going to see, all this didn't last for too long. And this is a pattern that we've come to see over and over again throughout our study, going back now a couple years, I guess, though interrupted by COVID. And I would suggest that all of this was effectively a renewal of the covenant which God had established with the people way back at Sinai all those years ago. And now the people are once again promising to serve him. They were promising to be his people if he would be their God. And looks like we're about out of time, so I will stop it there. And we will begin next week just stepping back for a few verses and going through that long prayer in chapter 9. Thank you.